Position number 21118, Reel 9.
Fred Cooper, Reel 9.
So he said at just before first light, he said, I want you to do this patrol. He said, cross the road against that wall, go down about 300, 350 yards. He said, you'll find an opening. Farmhouse on your left and farm buildings on your right. Go through there, he said, and about 100 yards, he said, you'll find another road coming in on your right leading to a bridge. He said, now, we want the tanks want to use that bridge in the morning, he said, and we want to know what's on it and whether it's wide or anything like that. So the company commander said to me, Sergeant Cooper, I don't want a quick shifty. He said, this is very important, he said. I want you to go over the bridge, what kind of bridge it is, iron bridge, type of bridge, type of obstacles on it, if there are any obstacles. I want you to feel on it for wires and that. He said, and go right over the bridge. So I thought to myself, well, that's a bit of a tall order, you know. And he said, and if you see any civilians, he said, bring them back. Bring one back. So with that, he disappeared. So just before first light, the officer, Elgar, said to me, I know, Sergeant Cooper, where are you going? Good luck. And when they say good luck, you know that you know that you're going to need it. But anyway, we shot down, thought to myself, well, if the army say it's 300 yards, it's probably about 600 yards, you know, but sure enough, 300 yards, we found this opening. And the farmhouse were on the left and the farm buildings on the right. Now, the first farm building we come to was a sort of A shed, and it had those split type of doors, like stable doors, where the top half can work independent of the bottom half. So we pulled the top half apart, and looking down, there was an old fella down there, and he was forking over some hay, and he had a little tinny lamp at the side of him. Give him that. So I said to one of the lads, I said, look, you stop here, watch him, don't let him get away, we'll take him back. So with the other fellow, we went to this bridge. And where he said, go over the bridge, I'd done what I thought more than I thought 99 out of 100 people in that position would do. I went halfway over the bridge. It was huge tree trunks on it. I felt around for wires. I didn't go right over the bridge, but I felt around for wires. Nothing there. As soon as we'd done that, straight back. In this shed, the old fella's still forking away. He's got his back to us. When he's in full flight with a fork in mid-air, grabbed him underneath his arm and run him back to our platoon headquarters as quick as we could. So, and you could feel him, he was about 90, I think. But anyway, you get back there and I give a report. I said, it's an iron bridge with a hump. I said, it's got eight... tree logs across it, or whatever the number was, and I said it's wide enough for tanks, and that was it. So with that, he's back to company of course in a jeep with the old fella. So that was about 6 o'clock in the morning. Anyway, about 9 o'clock, along comes the jeep. Sergeant Cooper wanted at company of course. So folks said, what's this all about? So anyway, goes company of courts, which is an old Frau's kitchen, you know, and these big kitchens, big tables, and he's got his maps out and all. Oh, hello, Sergeant Cooper, he said, don't you know him. Thank you for the report, he said. The tanks are going through over that bridge, he said. Accurate, he said, and they're grateful for the report. He said, you got it right. He said, so I thought to myself, this is funny. If I've done one, I must have, in the Western Desert in Italy, I must have, and in Europe, I must have done 200 patrols. I've never been called up by the company commander before. I thought there's something in this. So he said, excellent, well done. So I said, thank you, sir. So I saluted. So when I got the door, I put my hand on the door number, and he said to me, by the way, Sergeant Cooper, he said, next time you bring a civilian back for questioning, give him a good shake up and make bloody sure he's not deaf and dumb, will you? So I I said, yes, sir. Got the hammer door and thought, got the other side of the door and thought to myself, Jesus Christ. But that, after that, we came to, I think, the only operation after that of note was one where, unfortunately, the platoon commander got killed, it's Elgar. 3 days before, we'd been notified that he'd got the... No, 3 days after, I beg your pardon. 3 days after he got killed, we got notified that he'd been awarded an MC for the Elmendorf farm operation. But what happened? We got to a place in Germany called Westerwolseder. Yeah, spelt with a W, but pronounced with a V. And we got there early in the morning, and surprisingly enough, had a bit of security there and enjoyed for a long time. It was a large area had been designated an open area. Red crosses all over the place, you know. And when the convoy stopped, we were in the middle of this and felt secure, you know. Hospital tents and all that sort of thing there. German. And felt secure in the place. Anyway, this was early in the morning, you know, until about 8 or 9 o'clock or something like that. O group. So, with a platoon commander. They called his section together and he said, see that farmhouse and farm buildings now, right across an open field? He said, that's our objective. He said, what is happening? He said, there's people there defending some 88 millimeter guns. He said, and those guns are on a high ground, looking down beyond and holding up two armoured columns of ours. And he said, our job is to clear it. Yeah. Unfortunately, he set out a tactical plan, which to me was something out of the First World War. He had my section on his right, with himself in the centre, and Corporal Butler's section on the left, with Corporal Butler next to him. And he had a further section behind, and a platoon sergeant behind him with the 2-inch mortar, which is always there. If you get in difficulty, it smokes you out. So we proceeded, and on the right flank of my section was a track, a fairly deep ditch and a track. And we proceeded toward the objective, and he called me over and he said, Sergeant Cooper, will you extend your section across the track, because Corporal Butler has got a, using military terms, a post and rail fence which is coming in obliquely, cramping him up. As he said it, a tremendous burst of machine gun fire, and I knew it was close because there are times when you hear the whistle of a machine gun, whistle of the bullets going by, but there are other times when they're so close you can hear the twirl of them, and I could hear the twirl of them. Of course, we immediately hit the deck. And normally, under those circumstances, whoever is in charge asks, is everybody all right? But there was nothing coming from him. So we waited for a while, nothing. So I was set next in command. I said, is everybody all right? No, there's someone over here, Fred. So I crawled over, burst a machine gun, you know, sporadic burst of machine gun. So, when I got to him, he said, I said, you all right, sir? He said, no, he said, I'm finished. He said, you know what you've got to do, now get on and do it, he said. So I said, well, what's the matter with you? Don't worry about me, I'm finished, he said, I'm finished. And with that, he just slumped. So, I thought to myself, we were then about 200 yards from the objective. You know, we'd come about 200 yards, and we're still about 200 yards from it. So I thought to myself, well, this is no good. I had learned, you know, from previous experience, that infiltration is the thing. You know, get behind them and they'll come out. So, bearing in mind you're under fire, I told the section to come over here and get in a ditch. And that took about, I suppose, about 20 minutes, you know, bearing in mind that the Germans were watching for any movement and would fire it. Anyway, eventually we got in a ditch and it then took about 10 minutes for me to communicate with them, you know. And I said to the Bren gunner, my Bren gunner, I said, when we move, I said, give us covering fire, don't matter what you fire at, I said, as long as you're firing. I said, but keep it well clear of us. Pass the word along out the back. When I moved, to follow me. And my heart in my mouth, but I'll give them the order to fire, got up, and I'll run like bloody hell to these farmhouse, down this ditch. Eventually got behind it, and the section was with me. They didn't fire at us. Probably never had time to switch their machine gun, but we got behind them, and they come out all over the place. I think we must have captured about 60. But then we started to run a bad luck after that. The company commander came up with the platoon sergeant, you know, who'd been at the mortar. Now the officer was killed, he'd obviously have to take over. So we followed around this house, and I'll never forget it, because the Germans, our people fired at it, and we were still firing at the objective when we were on it, which, you know, they normally don't do, you know, not kill their own troops. But they hit the roof, and I was standing under the roof, and a row of roof tiles, big heavy ones, came down and just caught me chin helmet and tipped it off my head, you know. So, Christ, if that had hit me on the head, I'd have finished up literally 6 foot underground, you know. But anyway, with the company commander, he was in front, and the platoon sergeant, and then I followed behind as the leading section. And we come to one of those, what do you call them points where they've got an electric generator? You know, sort of a housing, a brick housing for an electric generator for this farm.
Substation.
Yeah. And anyway, he crept round that, and unbeknown to him, there was a 88mm gun 300 yards away, and he fired a shell over open sights. And Roly Gibson, Bill Pickford, the platoon sergeant, were standing underneath, and it landed above their heads. Never hurt them. Everything missed them. And, but they were both deaf. Bill Pickford's ears were running almost immediately. Perforated eardrum, and his ears were discharging. Roly Gibson signed, and Roly Gibson said to him, you know, go back, sent him back. He couldn't hear himself. And he then said to me, well, the tanks are coming up. He said, stay there. So anyway, our tanks came up the road, and unfortunately, what had happened, the tank commander, the leading tank, had come round the bend too much, and Roly Gibbs said to me, now, get moving through the woods, he said, clear this wood, you know, there's a wood on the left-hand side of the road, clear it of any enemy, he said. All right, I was in charge of the platoon. So he said, and keep abreast of the tanks. Well, I took up a position in the wood. The tank commander, as I say, come too far round the bend, within view of this 88mm gun. And the tank commander was out the turret consulting his map. And my section was moving along in the woods. He fired a shell, which I was told afterwards completely decapitated the tank commander, but the effect of it, I had a lad behind me, he died about 18 months ago. I heard a loud cry. One look round, his eyes in the back of his head and it's pouring the blood. So I put a shell dressing round him, look round, there's another lad got a bit of shrapnel in his arm, and there's another one lying on the floor, all from this one shell ricocheting off the turret of the tank. When I went to the one on the floor, I bandaged this one up, went to the one on the floor, and on the ground, and they're pulling his pullover out of a big hole in his back. I know he survived, but he must have lost a kidney, you know. They were pulling it, bits of pullover out, dripping with blood. So then I had to arrange for, see, you've got a depleted platoon, already lost people in previous actions, you're depleted, you've got three wounded, so you need three people to look after them, which means you're going to lose six, you know. So anyway, I nominated people that, and you've got people in mind, you know, that to do this, people who are less like, who are going to be the least valuable if it comes to a fight. So you nominate them to do it. Anyway, when this happened, Rolly Gibbs came back to me and he said, the other platoons have made such advances, he said, they're on top of the enemy. He said, make your way back to company headquarters. So I led the platoon back to company headquarters and quite upset, you know, lost one with an eye, one with an arm wound, the platoon officer killed, one deaf, you know, about six casualties, and friends of yours, and, you know, quite upset. And it wasn't till I got back to company headquarters that one of the officers, Lord Trenchard, his old father was alive then, you know, the old Lord Trenchard, and he'd lost a couple of sons in the Air Force and had put this one in our regiment. And he came out of company office and I saluted him and he said to me, very well done, Sergeant Cooper, very well done. So it was the first time it dawned on me, you know, you're so absorbed in what you're doing that I'd done something creditable in the battle. And later I was awarded the military medal. But I've since thought about it and I thought myself, well, it didn't seem such a risk at the time, but with a machine gun and charging over 200 yards of ground was a bit much, you know. But after that, I think we didn't do much. That really was the back end of the war.
What date was this action on? What date was the action on?
Well, you know, it was quite close to the time that they capitulated. You know, it was probably about 3 weeks before. And our brigadier at that time, surprisingly enough, was Brigadier Carver. He took over on Normandy when the other Brigadier Curry, DSO and two bars, had got killed, and he was the youngest brigadier in the British Army, 29. He was our brigadier, and it's surprising enough, he became a field marshal. My company commander became a field marshal, and also in the same battalion, Dwayne Bramall became a field marshal. And I've since spoken to all of them, you know. I met Carver, in Denmark, and I had quite a long chat with him at the British Embassy, but I'll come to that when I wind up. After that, we went as far as the Dortmund-Ems Canal, and, you know, we went through, one night we went to Hamburg, and it was one of the most miserable journeys I've ever had in my life. We came down the road, and as we were going into Hamburg, I think for about 3 miles, there was nothing, you know, it looked in the dark as if it was demolished houses as a result of our bombing. But in fact, what it was rubble from the bombing taken on the outskirts of the town and just piled up by the roadside, you know. But it was a gloomy place, and when you got into the centre of the town, the railway station was below the ground level, and there was a little gap showing one solitary electric light bulb, and it looked as if the whole place was floodlighted, but, you know, it was so dark and gloomy. And we spent a bit of time in a place, a suburb of Hamburg, called Bergedorf. And really, you would not believe that that place, Bergedorf, was part of Hamburg. It was something like the Knightsbridge or Kensington of large houses, fish ponds, and, you know, people living in the Eighth and Luxury. An unfortunate situation there where we celebrated the liberation there, May the 8th. And when it was said that the Germans had capitulated and it had been signed on Lüneburg Heath, the company tipped out a load of wine that it had stacked up for that occasion from France and Belgium, you know, and they had a lorry full of it, and they were issuing it out, you know. And the officer said to me, look, we're 12 o'clock tonight, he said. We've got to go to, in the town, he said. I'll meet you out here at 12 o'clock. He said, we've got to put up very light pistols, he said, a firework display, you know, to celebrate the capitulation. So the lads were drinking this wine, and they went a bit too far, you know. There was one lad there firing the Luger pistol in the gardens of the house that we were billeting in. And so I took the magazine out of the gun, you know. I said, you play with that, you know, and took the magazine. Of course, nearly everybody had a Luger that they captured, you know, or taken off a German. And they were running out of the gun, mad. They weren't the only ones. They were, you know, everybody was happy the war was over, and some overdone it, overindulged. And anyway, I went out at 12 o'clock at night, and we put these very light pistols up, and the firework display, all over the place. We're going up everywhere, you know, very lights. And went back and I went to bed. And anyway, next morning, trouble. A jar of rum is sacrosanct, you know. Nobody touches a jar of rum. It's needed if you're going into an action. Anybody who wants a tot of rum, give them a bit of Dutch courage, it's there. The officer comes to me, Sergeant Cooper, the jar of rum is missing. So, anyway, he said, they're bound to be an inquiry about that. So he come back about half hour late and he said to me, don't worry about it. He said, I've been on the lieutenant, so he's got two jars, so he give me one. So, not a problem. So anyway, I said to one of the lads, who had the jar of rum? He told me, you know, because I used to enjoy that type of relationship with the lad. So anyway, that day, about 12 o'clock, company Sergeant Major sends for me. So I went over to company headquarters, and that was a posh house. You know, it was one selected and really had antique furniture, old paint, everything. So the company Sergeant Major said to me, Fred, you've got a problem. So I said, what's that? He said, well, you're platoon. He said, next door, he said, they got a 15-year-old girl. He said she was raped at 2 o'clock in the morning by one of your people. He said, obviously, there'll be an identity, he said, and we'll find out who it is. But he said, there's a possibility that we may be moving out of here at 4 o'clock. The reason is, he said, we may be going up to Denmark. He said, to liberate Denmark. So I said, all right. Kept fingers crossed. So, in fact, we did move. We moved up to Flensburg, and from Flensburg into Denmark. But on the way, I said to one of the lads, one of our confidants, you know, I said, who raped the girl next door? So he said, Newton. This was a chap from Blackburn. I used to be very friendly with him, but when they told me that, you know, I just turned against him, and I couldn't help myself. If dirty jobs come along, I used to give it, just couldn't help myself. I so detested him, you know. You know, if he wanted that sort of thing, there's ways and means of getting it, particularly in Germany. A tin of corned beef and do wonders, you know. And so I just couldn't help myself. I probably treated him unfairly, but he was lucky he got away with it, you know. But anyway, we went up to Denmark, and I couldn't believe it when we got to Denmark, because all the things that were rationed in this country, king cakes and all that sort of thing, they were there in abundance. Cheeses and that, oh, unbelievable. You know, we went all over. We were mobile. We went all over to Esbjerg, Copenhagen, Jutland, Zealand, you know, Kolding, all the big towns there, and done various jobs. And what the position was, and it was rather comical, really, we had, something like a quarter of a million troops in Denmark recuperating after service on the Eastern Front, with a smallish army of occupation, which had been guilty of many, many atrocities. You know, I found out just how much in 1995 when I was invited over there. But what our job was to see them out. And it was laughable, really, you know. We eventually got stationed on the Grenze, the border of Germany. And the Grenze is a mile wide, you know, from Denmark into Germany. And on the Flensburg side, the German side, was the Monmouths, and on the Danish side was the Carrars. And I had half the platoon for 24 hours, and the officer had the other half of the platoon for 24 hours. Well, our job was to see these Germans out, keep our eye open for anybody wearing the SS. If you see anybody in the SS, rope them up. You know, take them into captivity, keep them under surveillance, and they'll be subject to special treatment. So the company commander came round to me and he said, "Now, you've got a division coming through this afternoon." He said, "You'll never this is why I had to laugh at this, really. "You'll have a staff car come down and some of them are coming through at Armagh too. Now, if he does that, you tell him, no, you come through at 3 o'clock when half past three. If he says half past three, tell him, no, half past two. Don't let him tell you what time he's coming through, you tell him what time, you know." So, anyway, then instructions come that we look for the SS. No horses to go through. Anyway, the Germans trying to make an impression. The staff come down and said to me, "We're coming through Armagh 2 or something." I said, "Well, you can't come through Armagh 2 because we're busy. Make it Armagh 3, yeah, all right, Armagh 3. Anyway, Armagh 3, along they come. The officers on horseback with a sword, trying to march out respectively. Strict instructions, no horses to go through. Said to one of the lads, "Tell him he can't take the horse through." You know, the right cockney lad, because they're mainly Londoners, you know. Goes up the general, "Sorry, mate, you can't take the horse." So, anyway, gets him off the horse, he straightens himself up, marches out, and takes the horse to one side. And it was a bit of a performance for the horses. At the end of the day, we finished up with about three SS. And about 8 horses. So, anyway, we put the SS where they were taken away, company headquarters, and taken away for special interrogation. And one of them, I'll never forget it, he was a bit trucking. I saw him with the SS markings. So I went over and I grabbed him. So I said to him, "Hands up." And he wouldn't put his hands up. So I called a couple of the lads over, and I said, So when he said, rifles and that, lift up their rifles and that, and said, "Hands up." So he put his hands up, and I see him watch on there. So I thought to myself, I'll have that. You know, spoils of war. So I take the watch off. Mama, Mama, he said. So what's he on about? Mama, kill us. It had a dust cap over it, you know, the, like they used to have in the desert, a dust cap over the watch. Took the watch off and I put it in my pocket. And in those days, you just put all sorts of things in your pockets, you know. And